Let's continue today in 1 Kings chapter number 2 with Solomon's establishment of his sole kingdom. You remember that he was king alongside of his father for about 3 or so years till his father's death. And his father told him before dying, there's some things you need to take care of justice-wise. You need to keep your eyes open. You need to use your wisdom to make sure these certain persons get the justice that they deserve. And so we read about how Joab has been executed by Benaiah, and also how Adonijah has been executed because of the continuance of his coup, and how the high priest Abiathar, who was complicit with those two persons, ends up being sent into exile to his priestly city just a few miles north of the city of Jerusalem. And it's all on their heads because of their immoral and even unlawful behavior. Verse number 36 of 1 Kings continues on that theme, because there's another person that David had told Solomon to keep his eye on. And so here's that guy. Then the king sent and summoned Shimei. Shimei, remember, is the Benjamite who cursed David during the Absalom coup exodus from Jerusalem. And then when David survives that coup and comes back to the city, Shimei is there begging for forgiveness. And David tells him that he won't be executed, even though that's kind of what he deserves for his treasonous behavior. And upon his deathbed, David told Solomon, you need to make sure he gets what he deserves. Just keep an eye on him. So the king sent, summoned Shimei and said to him, build yourself a house in Jerusalem and dwell there, and do not go out from there to any place whatsoever. So he is now going to be put under capital arrest. He's going to live inside the walls of the city of Jerusalem. And if he goes outside of the boundaries of Jerusalem city, he is going to face a severe penalty. That comes up in verse 37. For on the day you go out and cross the brook Kidron, know for certain that you shall die. Your blood shall be on your own head. Now the brook Kidron is the east side of the capital city. It's the drainage wadi that runs all along the east side. But it's not just crossing that toward his old farm up in Benjamin territory that's going to get him in trouble. If he goes out the other direction, crossing, for example, the Hinnom stream that's on the south side of Jerusalem, or whatever the name back at this time was for the Tyropian Valley, which is the valley that goes all along the western side of the ancient city of Jerusalem, even going up along the western side of the Temple Mount. So any departure from the very clearly defined area of Jerusalem will bring execution for this guy. And he agrees to that. Verse 38, Shimei said to the king, what you say is good. As my lord the king has said, so will your servant do. And so Shimei lived in Jerusalem many days. And it appears to me that all of these events happened within a matter of days, perhaps a few weeks after the death of David in 978 BC, which would have been the 40th year of David and the 4th official year of King Solomon. Now, the story jumps ahead about 3 years after that. And I figure since we're just here, we might as well finish this story. So we have to fast forward about 3 years, which means we're going to move into not just simply a sabbatical year, which was the year following David's death. That's 976. That's a year and a half after David's death. But the Jubilee year is also due in the following year after that. So there's going to be 2 years of rest right on top of one another. Now, why is that important to the story? Because in the year of Jubilee, all indebtedness contracts are done away with. Everything. And so Shimei is going to be violating that release order in this story. So I believe this story happens in 975 BC. Here we go. It happened at the end of 3 years that two of Shimei's servants ran away to Achish, son of Maakah, king of Gath. So these guys should not have still owed money. They should not have still been in bondage to Shimei. They should have been released according to the law of Moses. But what do we see? Shimei goes after them, and they try to escape by going to a non-Israeli city. Even though it's inside the territory of Solomon's kingdom, it is a non-Israeli city with a semi-independent leader. Now, when it was told Shimei, "Behold, your servants are in Gath," Shimei arose and saddled a donkey and went to Gath to Achish to seek his servants. Shimei went and brought his servants from Gath. So he violates two things here. He violates the keeping of servants after the time of release, and he violated his agreed upon term of confinement that he was supposed to stay inside the boundaries of the city of Jerusalem. Verse 41. When Solomon was told that Shimei had gone from Jerusalem to Gath and returned, the king sent and summoned Shimei and said to him, "Did I not make you swear by he who is, and solemnly warn you, saying, 'Know for certain that on the day you go out and go to any place whatsoever, you shall die?' And you said to me, 'What you say is good, I will obey.' Why then have you not kept your oath to he who is and the commandment which I've commanded you?" The king also said to Shimei, "You know in your own heart all the harm that you did to David my father. And so he who is will bring back your harm on your own head. But King Solomon shall be blessed, and the throne of David shall be established before he who is forever." And then the king commanded Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, and he went out and struck him down, and he died. So now, pretty much all the people that David talked to Solomon about shortly before his own death have been executed because of their own free will choices, because they were ungodly people who could not behave themselves even when they were given parole, even when they were given mercy and compassion. They still did the wrong thing, and so judgment came upon them. And then the writer of 1 Kings, no doubt one of the prophets, says, "So the kingdom was established in the hand of Solomon." And so everything is now Solomon's kingdom. David is passed away, his body has been laid in the tomb, and people are now starting to get used to King Solomon being their leader. Now, 1 Kings chapter number 3. I believe, now takes us into the year following the death of King David, the year 977 BC, which just so happens to be the 480th year of the Exodus. Now, why is that important? Because that is the year that the temple foundation is laid. Solomon just simply waited until the calendar year following his father's death before starting work on this very important project. In fact, he kind of waits until the anniversary celebrations of Passover and Unleavened Bread are passed, and then he begins the work. But he's also doing other things that we should be aware of. Some of them good, and some of them unwise, which is kind of ironic since we usually think about Solomon and his godly wisdom. 1 Kings chapter 3, verse number 1. Solomon made a marriage alliance with Pharaoh, king of Egypt. He took Pharaoh's daughter and brought her into the city of David until he had finished building his own house and the house of he who is and the wall around Jerusalem. So Solomon is going to be engaging in this idea of marrying multiple wives from countries surrounding Israel in order to seal alliances. This was common practice, even though the Israelis were told they should not engage in it. They do. And the Egyptian connection is highlighted here, partly because of something that is related to the building project of King Solomon. He's not just simply going to build the temple of God, the palace of God. He will build a massive royal complex for himself between the existing city of Jerusalem, where the palace of David is located, and the temple complex that is going to be built up on the Temple Mount. And as far as I know, they have not excavated deep enough in this area south of the modern Temple Mount to find this royal complex's foundations. But we know that's exactly where it's at. And he will, that is Solomon, will have his princess from Egypt living in a separate residence in the city of David, that is in Old Jerusalem, until this temple complex is finished, or this palace complex is finished, and then he'll move her into her own residence there. And the reason he won't allow her to live in David's old palace in Old Jerusalem is because that's where the Ark of the Covenant has also been, and he will not allow any non-Israeli wives of his to live in the same complex where the Ark of the Covenant is located. So that it's this odd sort of thinking in his mind that even though he's marrying multiple wives, which he shouldn't be, he's at least thinking none of the foreign wives should be anywhere near where the Ark of the Covenant is, because that's the throne of God. Okay, verse number 2 in our passage. Another irony that's going on. The people were sacrificing at the high places. However, because no house had yet been built for the name of He Who Is. Now, the Israelis had been told early on that there was only supposed to be one place that sacrifices were made. That was supposed to be the tabernacle. But that all got disrupted big time in the destruction of the city of Shiloh at the beginning of Samuel's leadership. And when the tabernacle was rebuilt at Gibeon, the Ark of the Covenant was in exile elsewhere and was never brought back into the tabernacle complex. And so the idea of there being only one place that sacrifices are supposed to be offered kind of broke down during the period of Samuel and the period of Saul and the period of David, and now the early part of Solomon's reign. It's just become the norm that there are several different high places, that is, complexes on the tops of hills that have altars that are devoted to the one true living God. And people go there as a matter of convenience to worship God at that sacrifice point. And so the writer of 1 Kings, the prophet, I'm sure, is just letting his readers know this is the time before the temple brought back the idea that there's only supposed to be one place that sacrifices are offered. So people were worshiping in a variety of places. Okay, that was all introductory to this event, 1 Kings 3:3. Solomon loved He Who Is, walking in the statutes of David his father, only he sacrificed and made offerings at the high places. So Solomon did love God. As a young man, with David's guidance, Bathsheba's guidance, he loved God. And he tried to do the right things for the most part. Unfortunately, there were some cultural things that Israel had accepted that Solomon also fell into, including the marrying of multiple wives. But the thing that we're focused on here is that he made it a habit to go around to the different places worshiping God by offering sacrifices at these special worship sites. Verse 4, the king went to Gibeon to sacrifice there, for that was the great high place. And Solomon used to offer 1,000 burnt offerings on that altar. Now that's a reference to the new tabernacle built in the time of the prophet Samuel. It's just a few miles to the northwest of Jerusalem. And because it's the place where the great big bronze altar is located, it was counted as the most significant of all the high places of Israel. So Solomon went there and did special worship, apparently offering at one time 1,000 burnt offerings. Verse number 5. At Gibeon, He Who Is appeared to Solomon in a dream by night. And God said to him, ask what I shall give you. So God allows Solomon to make a request of him. Verse 6, prompted by the teaching of his father, it says here that Solomon said, you have shown great and steadfast love to your servant David, my father, because he walked before you in faithfulness, in righteousness, and in uprightness of heart toward you. And you've kept for him this great and steadfast love and have given him a son to sit on his throne this day. So Solomon goes back over the story that he's probably been told many, many, many times as he was growing up, that David had wanted to build a temple, but he was told that it wouldn't be him, it would be a peaceful son of his that would sit upon the throne after him. And that's the reason why David named Solomon Shlomo, which means peaceful. And that this son wouldn't just simply build the temple, he would be the first of a long dynasty of sons of David, children, descendants of David, that would sit upon this throne of Israel. So Solomon thanks God for that. verse 7, "And now, O he who is my God, you have made your servant king in place of David my father, although I am but a little child." Now, remember, he was about 15, according to Jewish tradition, which I think makes good sense, when he was made king by David. So 3 or 4 years later, that's going to make him around 18, 19, heading toward 20. So he's still a young man when he's praying this prayer. 20 was the normal age that young men entered into the militia body. So he's really right around the same age as those that are starting their military availability. "I do not know how to go out or to come in, and your servant is in the midst of your people whom you've chosen, a great people, too many to be numbered or counted for multitude." So Solomon, again, I think echoing a lot of what his father has taught him, says, "I'm a kid still. I'm without experience. And here is the people of God, a huge number of them, hundreds of thousands of them." Verse 9, "Give your servant, therefore, an understanding mind to govern your people, that I may discern between good and evil. For who is able to govern this, your great people?" So Solomon's request is, "God, give me the wisdom I need in order to be a good king for the people of Israel." Verse 10, "It pleased he who is that Solomon had asked this. And God said to him, because you've asked this and have not asked for yourself long life," I mean, that would be a very obvious thing to ask, "or riches," that could certainly be something, "or the life of your enemies," that is, the people out there that might be a threat to you, "but you've asked for yourself understanding to discern what is right. Behold, I now do according to your word. Behold, I give you a wise and discerning mind so that none like you has been before you, and none like you shall arise after you." So this is where we find out that God is going to give Solomon an abundance of wisdom to make good choices. Now the irony is, he will not always use it. He will engage sometimes in behavior that goes against the wisdom of God. But he is famous for the fact that he was given wisdom and intelligence that surpassed his father and those that reigned in this area before him and those that followed after him. And his wisdom is going to be written down and passed down through generations and is still impacting us here today. But God's not done. Verse number 13, "I give you also what you've not asked, both riches and honor, so that no other king shall compare it with you all your days." So Solomon is going to be the richest and most well-known and honored king of the Middle East. The Solomonic kingdom will be the great kingdom of this time period. And even though it comes under judgment that wipes out a lot of that wealth and a lot of the things that indicated that wealth, such as the temple and the palaces, so that we don't even have archaeological ruins that we can kind of look at, the truth is written out here in the scripture that this was the climax of the Israeli kingdom. Verse 14, the conditionality that has always been there about the kingdom. Verse 14, If you will walk in my ways, keeping my statutes and my commandments, as your father David walked, then I will lengthen your days. So if you will do according to the covenant, I will give you long life and power and majesty and wealth. Verse 15, Solomon awoke. Behold, it was a dream. Now, it's not an ordinary dream. It's a dream vision. Then he came to Jerusalem, and he stood before the Ark of the Covenant of He Who Is, and offered up burnt offerings and peace offerings, and made a feast for all his servants. So remember, he had gone to Gibeon, just a few miles to the northwest of Jerusalem. And he offered all these different sacrifices. And then he slept there that night. He spent the night. And that's when he had this dream and found out that God was going to give him this special gift of wisdom. And so he gets up and comes back to David's original palace on the north end of the city of Jerusalem of this time. And in that palace is the special tent under which the Ark of the Covenant is located. It's a secondary worship site. And so Solomon comes back to that place and worships in front of the throne of God, offering sacrifices and thanking God for his promise. And then he begins demonstrating to the people this extra portion of wisdom. And this becomes something that becomes a bit of a legend that even non-believers will talk about the Solomonic wisdom as demonstrated in the dividing of the child, even though no child was divided. So we'll mark our place there, and we'll come back to the Word of God tomorrow as God gives us the ability.